Hello, you're listening to Wait, How Do You Spell That? A Rare Disease Podcast. My name is Colby, and I'm the editor here at Patientworthy. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. We really appreciate it. And today we're going to be discussing multiple sclerosis, also known as MS. That's a neurological disease that affects communication between the brain and the rest of the body. A person's immune system attacks the protective covering of nerve cells that allows them to transmit properly. In advanced cases, the nerves can be permanently damaged by the immune system's attacks. And to help in our discussion today, I'm happy to say we have a very special guest. Jennifer Angus is a patient advocate and para-dressage competitor who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2014. Jennifer has long been involved with athletics, having a history as a skiing instructor, and is a big advocate of horseback riding as a way to heal the mind and body. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Colby. I'm super excited to be here.
We're super excited to have you on and to share your story with our audience. And to start with, would you mind giving us an overview of multiple sclerosis for people who may not be familiar with that condition?
Well, I think you gave a super overview in the introduction, and it's an autoimmune disease. And basically, it's when a subset of the white blood cells go into the central nervous system. So that would be the optic nerve, the brain, or the spinal cord. And it goes in, and as you say, it attacks the protective covering of the nerves, which is called myelin. And it's a fatty tissue. And that fatty tissue is absolutely essential for the brain to send communication out to the extremities and also to have that go back up into the brain so the brain knows what to do, process it, and send information back out to the body. And so what happens is when the damage occurs in these areas where the fatty tissue is not there, on MRI, it shows up as a white spot or lesion. And it's white because it's got water in it. And so they know that it's a white blood cell that's in there. Wherever these lesions lie in the three parts of your central nervous system, so again, the optic nerve, spinal cord, or brain, is where the symptom will present for that person, generally speaking. Not all lesions will present a symptom, but it's very standard that there's certain areas where in multiple sclerosis, these lesions start and then they grow and they can just naturally, they can go anywhere. So multiple sclerosis is kind of like a Gucci disease because nobody has the same symptoms as the next person. And everybody's genetics are different. So everybody's response to how this, whatever happened is happening in the body with the disease is also different. So it's really, really difficult to figure out exactly how to treat one person to the next because, you know, we don't all react the same way. Yeah. So I guess that about sums it up. I could talk about the symptoms.
Yeah. If you could give us an overview of what the symptoms were like, or we'll get a little more into what you experienced, but what are some of the standard symptoms that someone might notice for MS?
A lot of people start off with issues with their eyes. And that's actually kind of a good thing in the sense that because you get diagnosed really early, so you would have vision issues. You could be blind. You could have see only a portion outside of your eyes or be discolored. There would be severe fatigue, emotional, dysfunction. There would be processing of the brain. There would be memory issues. There'd be something. I mean, and when I say fatigue, I mean fatigue that is so severe that you're lying in bed and you see the phone ring and you cannot answer it. It's just, there's just nothing in the tank to answer the phone. And you feel like you're dying. That's how I feel when I get that fatigue. So I don't know. Other people describe it as elephant legs. Like they can't just move anymore. It just stops. There's a lot of pain that's involved. A lot of different types of pain. Pain that you would never know that imagine that the body actually can create that. And it can all happen at once. And there would be, a lack of feeling. There could be spasticity is a really big one where you don't have control over a muscle contracting and it may stay contracted. It just, there's too much messaging going out to that particular area or that leg and it just stays completely stiff or it randomly flies up in the air or you could have tremors and there's bladder sexual bowel dysfunction. Those are also like very, very common with people with MS. So it's really an all-encompassing disease, I feel, because your brain is your hard drive. And then the messaging out to the body, the autonomic system, and down the spinal cord when that's affected, it's going to affect so many things in your body. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very tough.
And like you said, because of the variance in how this nerve damage can occur, how long it takes, that's going to be unique to each person, exactly what they experience, upon the onset of this. Why don't you also give us a little bit about your background? What was your life like prior to your diagnosis?
I had a really, really full life. Like it was, I just lived life to the max. I pushed the limits of everything that I could possibly do. My career was a rental property manager. I had a business, and on the side, I did vacation rentals and I taught skiing part-time. I also was an artist. That's probably one of my deepest loves and things I'm proud of. And I sold my works, and I was very, very athletic and into my sports and being healthy. I competed in my sports recreationally. I was not a pro at anything and loved the outdoors. I loved being outdoors, spring, fall, winter. I just loved it. I was a very social person. I really liked to laugh. And I had a number of different social circles, networks of friends. And, I think back and I used to just love listening to music and dancing the night away.
And so you were diagnosed then with multiple sclerosis in 2014. Can you take us back to that time in your life?
That was a really hideous, hideous period because it hit very, very hard. And I should say why it hit hard is because 10 years earlier, I had been misdiagnosed. So for 10 years, I had been having these relapses unknowingly, but they were relapses, and I had been to the doctor many times about this issue and this issue and this issue. And they gaslit me. They would say it was stress or it's your hormones, or there was always some excuse, So 10 years, the disease advanced. And by the time I was diagnosed, I was in really, really bad shape. So I got my MRI in December of 2013, and I had a panic attack. It's the only panic attack I've ever had. I screamed at the doctor, just give me the MRI because I can read it. I'll understand it. And I read it and I was like, that's it. I'm over. Game over. And I had a panic attack and I pulled myself together after that. I went up to the top of the mountain to meet a friend to go skiing. And I told her, and I was in tears, and I said, I don't know what to do. I don't even know what this thing is. I know what it does to people because I've seen what it does to people, and I'm really in bad shape. And I couldn't ski. All I could do was just slide all the way down on the green runs to the bottom. And I lived very close to the base of the mountain. And then pretty soon after that, January then at that point of 2014, and the neurologist that I met was the head of the clinic, and same clinic that misdiagnosed me 10 years earlier, ironically, and he immediately tried to turn the symptoms around that I had, because I was losing the ability to walk, I was losing the ability to use my hands, my brain was like milk toast, my left hand already had a tremor and it was kind of funky, and I'm left-handed, not surprised why I couldn't paint anymore. And so he threw me on very high dose of methylprednisone, which is prednisone, but given in IV form. So with MS, they do very high doses and then they stop, and to see if we could turn it around. So then, of course, I was able to walk again and my arms stopped moving and I could do a bit more. And then quickly it wore off, and I went back and he gave me more. That wore off, 5 days of that, and that wore off. And then I then got crutches to lean on and swing my legs forward to try to move from point A to point B. And then my arms gave out. Then I was crawling. And this all happened in a matter of 5 weeks, And then I had a couple of friends look at me on the ground there that morning of February 24th. And I just said, I have to go to the hospital. I have to go to the ER. I don't know what else to do for myself. Kind of a person that knows what to do always to help myself, and I didn't know anymore what to do. And so I went in, and the full body spasms had started, and they were like these exorcist like spasms that were so extreme, and it contorted my body into these positions that, like I said, you could never make it go that way if you tried, right? And the ER in the city that I'm from is Whistler. And so it's a ski resort. So there's many, we all know each other. So the doctors and the nurses and the admin staff. And And everybody was looking at what was happening to me going, oh my God, like, oh my God, you know, and it was so excruciating. And they were giving me more drugs and more drugs to stop these spasms because I would like get contorted back and hit my head on the wall or fall on the ground or lurch forward while trying to be wheelchaired to the restroom. And finally, I was stabilized and they sent me down to the main city, Vancouver, and I was there for 8 days and then went to a rehab hospital and to try to learn to walk again. And we're trying to figure out pain control and spasticity control. And they didn't even talk about how to deal with like the disease that was still actually going on inside me, because they were giving me, I think at that point I had had 13 or 11 infusions of this methylprednisone, which is, if this is 11,000 or so milligrams we're talking about, prednisone, which is a lot in a very short period. And that was really bad. And I went home and I didn't know what to do. And I was still trying to work because nobody knew how to do what I did. And I had friends helping me. I'd lie on the floor and I'd ask them, they'd read out the email for me and I'd ask them to type what I needed them to type. Or I knew the software, you know, so I would be able to see the software and I would say, click here, click, you know, and we would just make it work. And I kept relapsing. You know, I was put on a drug and then that one didn't work. And then another drug and that one didn't work. I relapsed and I started to lose my hair. And then I was fast tracked to the strongest drug on the market, which is alemtuzumab or Lemtrada. That was within the ninth month of the year of 2014. And it just kept getting worse. And so was kind of the start of the falling into the abyss, I would say, of the next 8 years.
Yeah. I'm very sorry that you went through that. That sounds absolutely terrifying. And to have that happen in such a short amount of time too. I mean, 9 months, the length of a baby coming into the world, you know, your life had changed from what you described before, having a lot of freedom, control over your body, to essentially not having any like that. That's terrifying. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
So, you know, we talked about earlier, there are different types of MS. Everyone's, you know, progression is different. They all have different experiences. One thing that you talked about for your experiences was you spoke about the MS poltergeist, this idea that you've come to think of your MS as, this idea that the disease is a beast that has crawled into your body, took everything over. Can you expand on that idea for us?
I'm sometimes not able to find words to describe how I feel physically or emotionally. So I find a metaphor. It's my creative brain, maybe, I don't know, but I felt like this creature, this monster crawled inside and was controlling my every breath, my everything. Like people say, oh, MS doesn't have me. Well, I can say to you, MS had every part of me. I couldn't think, there's nothing that I could do that this disease didn't have. And it was like seething, like, because I felt this, there was this horrific sort of electricity and vibration inside my body all the time. That was one of my symptoms. And so it was like this creature sort of crawling around and I feel these things happening, pinpricks, like bee stings. And it was like dabbing me. And I think because I felt so ill and so vulnerable that I could only equate it to being a beast that had taken over my body, my mind, my emotions, my intellectual self, my everything, my whole sense of self just was not there anymore. And I couldn't think of anything more blacker.
So would it be fair to say then you felt like a different person?
Oh, I was completely gone. I didn't feel like there was any Jenny left at all. Not on the outside, on the inside. It affected everything except my eyes. My eyes were good.
Well, you described for me as we were discussing prior to the show, your quality of life eventually had degraded to a point where you sought a request with Canada to end your own life. Can you tell us about that period in your life and what made you decide not to make that decision?
So by about June, May of 2021, my body had declined to a point where I was living in a pretty high level of indignity and the struggle just to get up, to feed myself and deal with the pain, manage all the medication and try to control my body. It had been going on for too long. And I had done every drug in the market. I had tried every different alternative lifestyle. It had nothing to do with me not having a positive mindset, because if I could have control over changing that with a positive mindset, that would have happened in the first year. So that wasn't it. Like, I can't tell you the stuff that I tried. And, you know, I had been begging my neurologist for an HSCT, a bone marrow transplant, since 2016. And he said, "You're too advanced. It won't work for you. All these other drugs haven't worked for you." And these drugs didn't sometimes just work for me. Like, I was allergic to them. And I had so many tertiary issues from those drugs as well. But the real kicker, and this is a really hard thing for me to share because it's extremely revolting. But what happened in the end was my body was shutting down, basically. And my bowel was so out of control. And maybe some people will hear this and they will go, "I get it. Like, that's me too." The bowel is a muscle and there's 33 feet of it. And when the brain oversends signals to it, and I mean, like, having diarrhea is like not even part of the discussion. This is like massive contractions of my bowel that would, like, I was exploding my innards. And it would go on for hours. And I would just hang over the bath stool, and I didn't know what to do. I would just have to stay there because there's no point in getting it out, because I just have to go back in. And it would happen at all these random times of the day, like 1 a.m, 2 p.m, 7 a.m. And, you know, like, my dog's looking at me, or before my dog got, you know, towards the end, he wasn't as bad off as I was at the time when I put him to sleep. And I thought, what's happening here? I don't have anything left. There's nothing anymore. I can't do anything at all, right? Unless somebody does it for me. And I just felt this disease, this beast was trying to kill me for over 7 years, and living like that and living without any hope. But mostly it was the body just saying, I'm ready to go.
So as a last-ditch effort, then, you received what's called a hematopoietic stem cell transplant. And I know you described how you used a lot of different medications. None of them worked. Some of them had very strong adverse effects on you. But this one, the stem cell transplant, actually ended up turning your life around. Can you tell us about that and any other treatments that you've had since then that have kind of pulled you out of that period that you were in your life?
Yes. And I'm afraid I should apologize. I didn't circle around back to your previous question, is that I did actually apply for medical assisted in dying in Canada, and I was approved for it. And it takes a long time to go through that because they're very meticulous. And I had a file that was about 10 inches high. Apparently the doctors had to read and they interview you. There was no trying to prove anything. It was just they talked to me and they read the file and they're like, you meet all the criteria. So I had that option available to me. And at the same time, this last-ditch effort, the option to have a hematopoietic stem cell transplant had been what I'd been asking my neurologist for, you know, the previous 5 years. And, you know, they do it in Canada for free if you have the right criteria, which I did not because I was far too advanced and they don't put resources into people that are that advanced. And so my family and my friends, a couple of friends, just said, "Why don't you try this? You're going down anyway. So you try this and, you know, maybe it'll work. But if it doesn't work, you're going down anyway." Right. So that's really how the decision came to. It was like that sentence. And so we called it my Hail Mary, which Americans will probably really relate to. That had a lot of meaning, strangely enough, and down the road, but it was my Hail Mary. And so there's only one place in Mexico that does this, and they're based out of Puebla, and they have a second office in Monterrey. So we I got the papers approved to end my life. And then they also said, yeah, we can take you. And I was like, it's going to be like $85,000. How do we come up with this money? And somehow my friends and family put it out there and people came forward so generously, so generously. It chokes me up thinking about that, you know, how people just care so much and they want to help. And yeah, so I went down and I was end of January. And so it was 2022. And that was 31 days I was there. And this treatment is amazing. It's very, very difficult. They essentially, we joke around that it tries to kill you and then bring you back to life again. I mean, you have to kill off every single white blood cell in your body. And with that, unfortunately, the chemo that's used is not selective. And when I mean selective, it doesn't attach to just your white blood cells. It kills platelets. It kills red blood cells. So You can run into issues, you know, there. You're also, when you do have no immune system, like when you have nothing, it takes time to reconstitute those blood cells. So you can pick up random infections just by breathing something, a pathogen in the air or a pathogen on a can of Coke that you haven't wiped down, or mineral water or something. So it was definitely the worst medical treatment I've ever been through in my life. But that's not how it is for everyone. Some people have it a lot easier. It's a very complicated process. And I think we could probably talk for 10 minutes about the process about it. But you get the idea. It's kind of, we say it's a reboot of the immune system. It's a non-myeloablative. There's a myeloablative. This is non, so it's not as intense as some regimes are in different countries or depending on your disease. So yeah, in Mexico, they have it down to a science. They've been treating patients for many, many years, and they've done over, I think, 2,000 stem cell transplants. And you mean that you do have to understand that there is a chance of, there's a 1-3% chance you might die. But for me, that was not an issue. It's more like I just didn't want to be left worse off. But then I had my, you know, so the closest to a cure that there is out there at the moment for this disease. And cure is a dangerous big word because it doesn't work for everyone. But it does work for a lot of people, especially if it's caught early. So if you wait until you're somebody like me, the statistics show that it's not going to work for you. So the fact that I actually started to get better through this nightmare treatment I went through. And let me tell you, if you read my blog, there's a moment there where I wish I had my childhood, my baby Lammy to hold, because I was so beaten down emotionally and physically. And I just, like, I didn't know which way one day, if I was going to go, if I was going to make it or not, you know? And so I defied the statistics, and for some reason I got better.
What was the first thing that you noticed? What was the first change in how your body was acting after receiving this stem cell transplant?
So after the fourth day of the chemotherapy, which is cyclophosphamide, I stopped. I've had a full body itch for years, like itch to the point where, like, I had scabs all over me from itching. It's just a neurological. That stopped. And then I got home, and I don't know, it was a couple of weeks. I think I see if I can walk a little bit. So I got my walker and I on video. And so it was a month post transplant. And I walked with my walker and I was like, oh my God, look at that. I'm not, like, if you had video of me right now trying to stagger and flip, there's videos on my YouTube channel of my attempts before the transplant and then after. A couple months later, I was like, I think I might be able to drive again. And, you know, I hadn't driven in 8 years. Like, I stopped driving because it was my right leg was most affected and I had foot drop, which is when you can't lift your foot up. And a month after that, I went out and I traded in my old, which was a fairly new vehicle, but like old in that sense, for a van so that I could put a scooter lift in the back.
And I'm like, I'm going to drive. I could drive. And I could. And I remember coming home with the van. It was trying to find a used van in the middle of a pandemic, which like, wow, it was tough. So I remember sitting there, I didn't have anybody with me. And I just was like, I didn't know whether to cry. I didn't know whether to scream and shout. I was like this grief of not being able to drive for 8 years. And now being able, I had now a vehicle and I could drive. I'm like, oh my God. Like, it was a complete mental enema. So those were some of the things that were, and then little other things changed. And then I walked outside for 40 steps without the walker. And then it just little bit by little bit got going. And then the next treatment I had was mesenchymal stem cells. And I'm not sure if I pronounced that correctly, which are different than hematopoietic stem cells. Those are blood stem cells. Mesenchymal stem cells are like medical signaling cells. And they are located in different parts of your body. And I heard about this trial, stage 2 trial in the US happening in outside of Houston in Sugar Land. And they were extracting fat from people's stomachs. And they were then extracting these mesenchymal stem cells out of the fat. So you can get them from bone marrow as well, but it's easier to get it from the fat and a whole lot less pain, like a lot less painless. So I didn't qualify for the trial. And then there's something that Americans should know about because it's legislation called the Right to Try. Do you know about that?
Yes. I believe we've discussed Right to Try with some other patients we've interviewed as well on the podcast.
Oh, super. And so I used that to access this drug when stem cells are considered drugs by the FDA. And I wouldn't go anywhere else other than to somewhere where I knew the FDA was. Like they were doing something under the watch of the FDA because I knew how the manufacturing process and whatnot. And the manufacturer agreed to it and he paid the manufacturer's wholesale cost of the drug. And so because I was paying for it, I had the option to have not just the IV, my stem cells given to me by IV, but also my spinal cord. Because these mesenchymal stem cells have the ability to rebuild neural tissue, for me, in my mind, it seems the most logical to have it put in my spinal cord. And that was a very painful experience for me. I was very sick after for about 2 days. I missed my flight. I had a huge fever. Like the agony in my hips was insane. It was like a Spinal Tap times 100. But I was back to baseline in 7-8 days. And then 3 months later, I woke up one day. Now we're getting towards a year post my bone marrow transplant. So 3 months later, after I had this stuff on my spine, I thought, I wonder how far I can walk. I just think I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to just go for a walk. And so I was by myself. So I took the walker and I went out on the street and I walked 900 steps. And I hadn't walked 900 steps in 9 years. Like some people can just shuffle along and just keep going. It may not be good walking, quality walking, but they can just keep going. It's like, that doesn't happen to me. It's like there is an end, you know? And so I went 900 steps and I was like, another one of those moments where I sit on the sofa, I don't know whether to cry or to scream, jump and shout, right? Like, again, it's just this mental enema, you know, you're full of this grief of how much you've lost with this elation, with this miracle that's just happened. And I haven't walked 900 steps again. I haven't tried. And it was like, okay, this is incredible. Like the first treatment was, I had a miracle response. This one, I had a miracle response. Like, why is this happening? This is crazy. This has happened to me. And I'm like so lucky.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after all that time, then you're walking again, you're driving again. You've become a competitor, which we'll talk about more here in a moment. But being here then, 10 years after your diagnosis and looking back on everything you've gone through, what are your thoughts?
When I read that in the questions that you sent me, I felt pretty gutted because I thought, has it been worth it? It was the first question that came to mind. And I'm just so, so sad that 8 years of my life were gone. They're gone. They were just wasted. Time was wasted. And then now these last 2 years where I've had improvement and I've actually had an ability to live, you know, my little tiny box I lived in before, the little cage has now like become it's bigger. I still have a lot of struggle, and I, you know, there's a lot of disabilities outstanding. And but it's like, wow, I don't know why I've been chosen to be the lucky one, is what my thoughts are. And I just never ever want to go back to that place and live the way that I lived. Like, I just never, I'll never do that. I think when you don't realize how bad things are until you start to get better.
Mm-hmm.
It's that sort of thing. And yeah, just horrible thinking of all that past, and just the difference of just give me a little bit and I'm going to run with it, you know, mm-hmm. just, yeah.
And as we mentioned before, now you're heavily involved with horseback riding, particularly the sport of para dressage. Can you talk about dressage? What is that for people who don't know? And what drew you to getting involved in that?
Dressage is where you see the riders do, it's kind of, they call it dancing, but it's horses that are very, they stretch their legs out long. They trot and canter sideways. They canter on the spot in a circle. Mm-hmm. They do these fancy movements. And so it's a test that you ride. And then you have the ability, if you qualify, then you ride your own test that you create to music. So you ride a freestyle. And it's really exciting. It's a very, very difficult sport. It's a sport that you spend your life really just developing. And there's never an end to how much you keep learning, right? And yeah, I'm just super obsessed with it.
Yeah, and you recently then, now you've become part of the national team program for Canada as a para dressage rider. I know you're going to be competing next week. You have the ultimate goal of being a Paralympic competitor. Can you talk about how this new chapter in your life, including your work with horses, has changed things for you?
Yes, horses are incredibly healing creatures. And there's studies out there that show that the walk of a horse is the most similar to the walk of humans. So when you're on horseback, the biofeedback to the brain is that you're actually walking when the horse is walking. So the horse gives you their legs, essentially. So as somebody who has lost neurological ability to walk or to stand or having trouble with it, this can be incredibly healing because it can create new neural pathways where you then walk better, you stand for longer. And it's not just that, but it's the being around horses, the emotional component, right? You want to touch them. They nuzzle you. They, you know, it's just, it's lovely. And so I didn't just jump into dressage. I had been riding, you know, when I was younger and through my teens and then in different parts of my life. And I started as a rehabilitation facility for people who were disabled, that who had PTSD, who had, you know, children, adults. It was all different types of ages and disabilities. And so I started to ride there in 2020, but someone had to take me. And, you know, they have these long ramps for the wheelchair, or they have a hoist if you need it. And, you know, we had it all timed down to the horse would get there and you literally like stand on the stirrup and the other stirrups there. And then you know, you're on the horse. So it started out that way. And then it quickly, muscle memory came back, and I just didn't feel disabled when I was on the horseback. And then I guess it was a couple of years ago, and I found a dressage barn, and I thought, I want to do this. I want to compete. And I've always competed, like, so nothing new, you know, like about Jenny, and just having a goal and like going for it, right? And so I thought, I think I can do this. I kept it to myself, but that competing internationally, and then once you compete internationally and you get the scores, then you qualify for the Paralympics. And then, of course, in between the Paralympics are the World Equestrian Games, which are a huge thing as well, which is also a goal of mine. But, you know, you don't just stop there. I mean, you can keep competing as long as your body holds up and you have funding. And so, yeah, that's how it got back into it. And then when I had more functionality, it was like, yes, all right, let's go, kind of thing. And so here we are, and I've been training a lot, and I read a lot, and I watch a lot of videos, and horses are my life. I'm there. It's my everything now, and it's given me a purpose, and I don't want to say that without a horse, I don't have a purpose just with my own self. That's not entirely true. But when you do have responsibilities with a horse, you are there all the time, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of horse care and lots of so many things to think about. So yeah.
It's great. Where are you competing next?
It's in Europe. And yeah, so well, I'm hesitant to say too many details because I don't want to jinx it. Yeah. So we'll see how it goes this time. And yeah.
All right. Well, that's great to hear, you know, and when you said the study about the biofeedback from horses, the mechanics of a horse walking and how similar that is to humans walking, you know, and I just had a minor in history. So I'm always thinking of like historical human development, stuff like that. And I wonder if it's similar, you know, humans have developed and have domesticated horses for a long time now, similar to dogs, you know, so I wonder, do we just kind of have an inherent link there? You know, I don't know what the answer is there, but that's certainly intriguing to think about. And certainly seems to have done you well too.
There are many rehabilitation facilities across the United States and in Canada. Cantra is the typical one in Canada, and in the United States, it's PATH International. And if I do a search, there's almost always one or two facilities in each, or if not more, in each state. Mm-hmm. And so and you don't have to know how to ride either. That's a thing. And I think the history with horses is because you think about warfare, and horses were used in warfare, and how dynamic a horse used to have to be to rear up, to spin on its haunches, you know, to do all those things in warfare. So there's a connection with humans. It's very, very longstanding history.
Right. Well, if there is somebody in our audience today who's in the same shoes that you once were, facing down a new MS diagnosis, what advice would you have for them?
The first thing I'd want to say is, I want to give you a hug. Yeah. But then I would say, start educating yourself on the disease, on the drugs, and make sure that you've got a book, a little tiny book, even if it's this size, and that you advocate for yourself. If you feel something, you tell your doctor. If you want something, you tell your doctor. You do not walk out of that doctor's office without getting what you want. And there's three things that you can usually go into a doctor's office with. Three goals, three questions that you want answers to. Mm-hmm. Write them down so that you're square, because having MS, it really messes with your memory and your ability to sort of stand up for yourself. So it's really hard. So if you have something written and concrete that you can say, well, I think this would be good. Let's try this. And yeah, I mean, I'm supportive of anybody's decision on whatever they think is best for themselves. So that's my standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I think though, when I first was diagnosed, I just wanted the strongest drug. Just give me the strongest drug. Get rid of this thing. Get rid of this beast. So I think the sooner and the harder that you hit the disease, the better off you will be in the future. It's a hard thing to think about. And I know there's insurance and they want you to try the first line drug, which is crap. The second line drug is also probably pretty crap. And then they want to make sure that you get worse before that you qualify for the strongest drugs. It's like, it really, really sucks. But stay on it, get copies of all of your reports, get copies of your scans, if they're MRIs or even if you have ultrasounds or anything, always keep copy of everything. Be a control freak.
Yeah, well, you know, not advice you're likely to hear in any other scenario, but one that sounds like it's something you have to do for this one. So thank you. I think that's good advice. And of course, you've written about this topic, your experiences, what you felt, how you felt. And you've also written about your experiences on your blog, like you mentioned earlier, what you felt, how it made you feel. You're putting your efforts with dressage out there. If someone would like to keep up with you, read more about what you experienced, what you're doing with horseback riding now, or maybe connect with you regarding multiple sclerosis, what are some of the ways that they can get in touch with you?
Oh, they can go to my website, which is my blog, super easy, and we can put it in the show notes. It's just ms.jennyangus.com. And I have attached in there with the blogs that I wrote, YouTube videos. So I have a YouTube channel with a lot of videos on there and some crazy stuff, some like, you know, lots of different things in there. I've also written for multiplesclerosis.net. I've written maybe 10 plus articles for them. different things. So in my Instagram account, the medical journey, sort of Jenny Angus, the disability advocate Jenny Angus, in there, I have a link tree. In my link tree, it's got links to all my website, my blog, my articles. And I also have a separate Instagram account that's the Jenny Angus para rider. So para rider, para dressage rider, kind of mm-hmm. the same thing, so just to keep it. So I put what I'm kind of doing there. And I was also on Facebook. So whatever, that's pretty, I'm pretty prominent on Facebook as well. I have strong views, let's put it that way.
Well, then, Jennifer, before we move into the outro, I always like to give people the chance. Is there anything that you'd like to expand on that you talked about today, or any sort of closing thoughts that you might have before we wrap things up?
The place where I was in, where I was unable to do anything at all mm-hmm. and was living alone and didn't have any hope. And it's very, very hard to find hope when you're in that place. And that's a really normal thing to feel. And it's normal to have a situational depression when you're in that place, and it, having been told by a neurologist that your prognosis is really grisly. Like, those words are really, really awful. I hate that someone would ever hear that. And if they do, and if they ever need to reach out and just like, hey, what up? Reach out to me. I get it. Reach out to me if you have questions on hematopoietic stem cell transplant. It's autologous, so that means from your own. It's not a donor. Or the mesenchymal stem cell, the way that I got at it through the Right to Try It, Hope Biosciences, an amazing company. And yeah, just horseback riding. Any questions on that, just use my Instagram and message me. And follow me, but send a message so that I know who you are. Because sometimes people hide their... you know, that it's private and I don't always, you know, what it's about, or they can send me an email from my website. I'm really open to helping people. I know how it feels to be on that back end of being really confused and not knowing what to do. And so my ears are open, and whatever I can do to help anybody else, I want to.
All right. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today. That's a tough journey. I'm sure it's a tough journey to share again, but we really appreciate you sharing your story and the long road you've walked to get to this point. And good luck with your competition next week, too. Hopefully we haven't jinxed anything.
No, we haven't jinxed anything. Thank you so much, Colby. I'm really, really honored that you asked me to be here and share my story. Thank you. It's such a pleasure speaking to you.
Of course. Thank you so much for being so open with it as well. And if you'd like to follow along, like Jennifer said, with her dressage competitions or connect with her regarding MS, any questions that you have, she's open. We'll leave links to all the ways that you can do that in the show notes for this episode. And remember, you can always keep up with the latest in rare disease news by visiting our website. That's at patientworthy.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and more. Just search for Patient Worthy on those platforms and you'll probably find us. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and leaving us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. Subscribing ensures you'll automatically receive our new monthly episodes as soon as they come out, and a review or rating really does go a long way toward helping us out. Finally, if you have any questions about the podcast or perhaps an idea for a future episode, you can get in touch with me by sending an email to Colby, that's Colby, at patientworthy.com. That does it for today's episode. Thank you once again to Jennifer Angus for joining me on the show today. And as always, thank you for listening.